I would like to start 20 years ago, mm-hmm. or like even 25 years ago. Rusty in UK on car boot sale markets, in basements in New York, in Jamaica maybe, in search for roots reggae dub,
mm-hmm.
12 inches, or what was the state of Rusty 20 years ago?
Well, you might go back even a bit further than that still. I was going
go back as far back as you feel like.
Well, for reggae for me started in 1978. It was after the punk thing. You know, I've been into the Sex Pistols and all that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when they broke up, to me that was the end of punk as far as I was concerned. I don't know what anybody else thought, but that was all it was meant to be, you know. Because punk was doing away with that whole rock and roll thing, you know, 30 years of, you know, rock and roll superstars and stuff. So, yeah, 1978 coming on. My brother, who was 5 years older, was into reggae music from a little bit earlier, you know, from the early 70s and stuff, with things like the club reggae and club ska and that kind of stuff there, you know. But not heavily. I mean, you know, he was into rock music and stuff. But anyway, 1978, I mean, I was 15, 16 at that time. And just thought, you know, I used to hear these tunes coming from my brother and stuff, and thought, yeah, you know, that I liked that. I was interested in that. Asked him what a couple of albums was to get, and it was, you know, he kind of said Dr. Lamentado, Best Dressed Chicken, yeah. and Joe Gibbs, Chapter 3 in Dove. Yeah. Bought them two albums, and it just kind of lifted off from there. But we was out in our own little kind of sector, you know. We lived out in the suburbs. I still live there now. So we didn't really know anybody. We just kind of, you know, took in what the things that we kind of liked. The music press was quite heavy on reggae at that time as well. You know, you could read all these articles about a lot of these artists and stuff. You know,
Echoes.
In Echoes, in New Musical Express, Melody Maker, Sounds, Record Mirror, all of them would have articles and stuff on reggae music at that time. Unlike today, not that most of them exist anyway. So, you know, you kind of learn, and there was good writers in them magazines, you know, people like Carl Gale, Penny Real, Chris Lane, you know, people that really did know the music deeply from years before and stuff. So, you know, you got a good inroad into the music through that. And then a little later, you know, you had David Rodigan come on the radio, you know, his early shows on Capital Radio and stuff. And, you know, another guy that knew his music, so you'd hear all these wicked tunes, you know. I can remember some of his first shows where he, you know, would play like a new version of a tune, say like 10 to 1,
mm.
you know, and then, you know, there was a new version at the time by George Addison. And then he would play the Johnny Clark, you know, Bunny Lee piece. And then he'd pull out the Studio One Mad Labs piece, mm. and you'd just be like goosebumps and, you know, just, oh yeah, wicked, you know what I mean? Just hearing that, and, you know. And so, you know, we just loved the music from then times there, and, you know, start going into London, up to the record shops and stuff, mm-hmm. find out where some of these other places, finding the Studio One shop, Peckins, down in Askew Road, mm-hmm. in Shepherd's Bush, and just get into it from that, you know. Mm-hmm. Also, at the same time, there was an article, there was a magazine back home called Time Out. It's like one of these kind of like listings magazines, you know, for shows and clubs and all them kind of things. Mm-hmm. And they did an article on all second-hand record shops in London. And there was one set of them called Record and Tape Exchange. So we went up there, and it was a gold mine, because it wasn't like collector's times in them days, you know. And you couldn't hear the tunes, but you know it was just a world of tunes, and it's, you know, you're paying like 20 pence, 30 pence for a tune. 70 or 80 pence was like a big price,
right.
You know, 20p for a 12 inch. So you could just buy even though you didn't, you know, them days when money wasn't, you know, you walked home with like 20, 30 pound take home pay, mm. but you could still buy a lot of records, you know, for a five or for 10 pounds, you know. So up there every week, sometimes two or three times a week, just hunting tunes out. Picked up a lot of good tunes. You know, you come home with like 30 tunes, and out of that, you know, a good 90% of them will be good tune. Mm, okay. The other 10% you take back the next week, sort of thing, you know. So you picked up a lot of things through that.
Mm.
So that was my kind of my record collecting.
At that time, do you had a concrete idea of what you have been after? Like, was it like the dub kind of thing?
Which it was reggae, because it was less defined in them days as well. Mm. You know, reggae wasn't sort of, it wasn't grouped into these kind of little corners so much. you might have had sort of, you know, Lovers Rock and Roots and all that kind of stuff. But dub and roots, dub and reggae was the same thing.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, you didn't, it, and still today I would say it's the same thing. But in them days, definitely no one kind of defined the real difference between that. It all, you know, dubs were dubs of reggae tunes. But for me, it was roots reggae, mostly, you know what I mean? It's like, you know, the... And dancehall in that time as well wasn't really kind of like how people perceive dancehall these days. It was more kind of rubber dub. So even the dancehall rhythms would be quite heavy. Some of them could be very heavy.
Yeah, rockers.
Rockers and all that kind of stuff.
As far as I know, the production thing came in after Shaka somehow picked up on your first...
I'd been playing bass guitar from when I was 15, but never took it seriously enough. I think my brother, you know, from an earlier time was playing rhythm guitar and stuff. But in about 85, you know, I started taking interest in making music, just real simple at first. I remember having, I had a nice hi-fi at home, and I had this tape machine with, you know, like mic inputs and stuff. I found a way of setting it up, and I could do this thing with a microphone where I'm going from the bass speaker to the mid speaker to the treble, and out of phasing it with the center, with a speaker in the room. And it was giving, you know, play a dub tune. I remember one particular one, which was King Tubby's Meets the Rockers Uptown, which was always one of my favourite dubs anyway. But doing this thing with that, and it's just like, oh, it's almost like I'm doing a remix. And that kind of interested me. But then it was like, okay, that's pretty limited after a while. Then I started seeing things in the magazines about, you know, you could buy a four-track machine, you know, like the Porter Studio, the cassette four-track, and cheap drum machines and things, you know. So I thought, yeah, that's affordable for me. I can, you know, get it on higher purchase and just try a little thing at home, you know. So I bought a four-track and a drum machine. I played bass, had some real cheesy little keyboard, and was just trying things, you know. Then, like everybody sort of starting out, it was rubbish, complete and utter rubbish, you know. But then you start to progress and stuff, you know, and it's like the first drum machine that I had, it was like, got rid of that and got a slightly better one. And things kind of progressed a little bit. And then my brother come into it. He heard the progression and he come into it. So we started to work together and stuff. Mostly just doing over, you know, our favourite rhythms and stuff. I would say, you know, for myself, I didn't really know how to, you know, do original bass lines and things. You know, that really was like a learning process. So we just did, you know, did over old tunes, favourites, Phrony Corn and kind of real rock and all that, you know. But then, you know, sort of around 85, you had a record shop open up in Camden Town called Flash Forward. And the three guys that worked in there were long-time Shaka fanatics. So anytime you went into the shop, they'd be playing Shaka session tapes. And we started hearing that. You know, we haven't been around that scene at all. But we started hearing these session tapes and was like, wow, that sounds wicked. You know what I mean? How that's coming across, you know, these open-mic recordings of Shaka sessions and stuff. And straight from that, you know, I'll come home and start building the tune to make it sound like that sound, you know, this really kind of like slashing kind of top end and rolling bass line and stuff. Then I kind of, you know, it was like, okay, that's kind of nice. And, you know, we started to progress and stuff. But the one thing that I always felt was like, you know, hearing these mixes like straight up off, you know, I used to mix onto cassette tape as well. Hearing them off the cassette tape, they sound very clean and, you know, not like my old records, you know, which, you know, Studio One has got all the bacon fry crispiness to it and stuff. And I wanted to hear what it sounded like that. So I went and found out, you know, you could do a cut a dub plate and them kind of things. So I went and cut a dub plate of a few tunes just to hear how that was. And it was all right. Another few months passed, done a couple of tunes. But because we were starting to have more influence from Shaka, still not having seen him yet, but just hearing these tapes. You know, I was building some tunes more in that kind of style. Got another dub plate cut. I remember playing it to the guys that worked in Flash Forward, one of the guys in particular, and he said, oh, you should take it to Shaka. He'd be into that. And, you know, I'm thinking, went down to another shop, went down to Peckin's Studio One shop, and Peckin's younger son, Chris, at the time, he said exactly the same thing, you should take it to Shaka. So, we took it to Shaka. Shaka had a shop in New Cross, an arts and craft culture shop. We went down there. This is during the week. One of his box boys was in there, a guy called Asa. And we had no real kind of plan about what we was doing with the plate, you know, what would happen with Shaq. We just kind of wanted to see what opinion he would give on it, you know. Mm-hmm. So his box boy said, yeah, leave it with us. Shaq will be on Saturday, come back then. So we left the dub plate there. Come back Saturday, and there's Shaq standing in the shop holding our dub plate. And, you know, we come walking through the door, and he looks up and said, you made this? I said, yeah, yeah. And it was like four different tunes, and he said, straight away, he said, I want four pieces of each tune and anything else you've got. And gave us a flyer for the next week's dance and stuff. So it was just like, you know, we come away from that thinking, oh. You know, because, you know, the other thing you've got to remember at that time, it was like there was no white people involved in making that kind of music. You know, white people's involvement in making reggae music, you know, to the most was 10cc and Blondie and maybe UB40, you know what I mean? But, you know, none of UB40 might be the closest to any of it, but that music there wasn't being played down at Shaka and them kind of things. It wasn't really being played by your roots people. It was all commercial. So, you know, to even have been accepted by Shaka as having done this and stuff, and there was no like, you know, look us up and down and like, boy, white boy is doing this and all that, just total acceptance and, you know, come to the next dance. So it just kind of took off, yeah.
So was it like the feeling, a new kind of generation of people coming together, like Alpha and Omega?
Well, it was, at the same time as we was going, you know, Manasseh had started their sound system. Manasseh had really kind of was doing the sound system before they was making their music, or the music was really getting out to people. Alpha and Omega were based down in Portsmouth. I think they had released a single, maybe as early as 85. But wasn't really known. You know, nobody knew who they were, you know what I mean? And none of us knew each other, you know. It's like Shaka was in there with the people that he'd known for years, Twinkle Brothers and Vivian Jones and, you know, whoever from Jamaica and whoever else was on the UK roots and reggae scene. But there was like this little pocket. There were some other guys, Teamworks, and some black guys as well. You know, you had obviously Blacker Mix and Dub Judah. I don't know how early Dread and Fed were going from, but there was other people sort of doing a thing, but all out on their own, mm-hmm. you know. But then at the same time, you know, Shaka was kind of one of the main focuses for a lot of us. You know, we had made this connection for him, and you know, he was playing our music on his sound. So we started going to his dances, and you start hearing a whole bunch of new tunes, new productions. You don't know who they're by. You're wondering who's making this, because you can hear it. Some of it's new. You know, when he's playing dub plates and stuff. Sometimes you just think, oh, maybe it's Shaka stuff or it's, you know, Twinkle stuff. Then, you know, you kind of find out, he might call a name that you don't recognise and it's like, oh. So, you know, you find out there's these pockets of people doing things. Manasseh had a much higher profile, partly through their background. You know, they went onto pirate radio station as well, onto Kiss FM. So their profile was quite up front, you know. I think Nick's father ran a Jewish newspaper. So they knew how to get in on the media kind of level, you know. So it's like, you know, you started seeing articles in the music press and stuff. Little things, you know, and it kind of all brought it together. And I think a thing for maybe a lot of white people, you know, I remember the first dances that I went to, there was, you know, you could count the amount of white people on one hand. You know, it was still quite a black thing, you know, but as it sort of, you know, over them couple of years there, 87, 88, it really become more open to white people. It was like almost like, you know, it's like you can come to these sessions, it's safe to go to, you know, these areas and come to a Shaka session. There's never no trouble in them dances, you know, differently than maybe if you went to dancehall dances or something. But these dances, no, you were safe. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, what a lot of white people could see that. And so these dancers suddenly, you know, white people that were into roots music suddenly started appearing at the dances. And you had an Asian contingent that was going there as well. They had been going from around 84, 85, you know, Sikhs were starting to get in there. Shaka would be playing down in Southall, which is an area which is quite an Asian area. So that had a little kind of section of crowd as well.
Would you say there was a huge difference between sounds like Coxon, Fatman, Joe Observer, Channel One, compared to where you went to?
Particularly with the likes of Coxon and Fat Man, because they were particularly kind of from an older school time, you know, and they were the big sounds from the older school time. I don't really know enough about sound like a Jar Observer's history, you know. I know they've been going for a long time, but I don't know their importance in the scheme. But obviously, a sound like Coxon was very important, you know. They was, you know, you might say one of the big three.
But their styles were slightly different.
I mean, from the earlier time, you know, it was, you know, because reggae didn't have them, it wasn't so divided, so a lot of sounds would be playing a lot of same music. But a sound like Fat Man and Coxon would also play maybe some Lovers Rock and maybe some dance or Rubber Dub, but it would be, you know, like Studio One versions and things like that, you know. So
would you say that Coxon was actually looking at Jamaica and bringing Jamaican stuff over to London?
But
Shaka was more with the wider view, giving white boys a chance.
It became that with Shaka, you know. I think, you know, before the likes of, you know, myself and
wait. At first, Shaka was strictly from Jamaica, but as he became started to produce and stuff, and then he started to bring in like the UK elements as well, and that's where it kicked off, really.
Yeah, definitely, you know, because I think up until about 84, maybe 85, you know, Shaka was still pretty much strictly playing Jamaican music. You know, the stuff, most of these old stuff that he would have been playing from 70s times and that. Obviously, you know, he was always making this thing back in the UK and Aswad, that kind of stuff there. But all that was very much in its style of roots reggae. You know, it still kind of fitted in with what was coming from Jamaica to a greater degree. So, you know, when people like myself come along, I think partly through we didn't have no kind of plan that we was going to come with a different style of music. I don't think any of us did. We just was doing, you know, our versions of what we kind of loved in the music. But through circumstance, maybe through equipment or skill level or whatever, it sort of started to have a different style. I always see someone like Dread and Fred had a very particular view of the sound and structure of tune that they was going for. And to me, they was one of the most revolutionary set of producers that really kind of did start to turn how a certain style of the music was going to go and stuff. You know, I would say they kind of very much influenced myself, you know, to move away from, you know, my most of my stuff up to a certain period was like, okay, we use a drum machine, but the rest of it was live bass and, you know, guitars and hand played keyboards and percussion, very, very much in a typical roots kind of vein. You know, if I programmed a drum, it was trying to emulate a live drummer. Mm-hmm. Whereas Dread and Fred wasn't trying to do that. They made the drum sound like a machine. Mm-hmm. You know, and when I heard that, it was just like, no, that's really interesting. You know, I didn't have computers, I didn't know about MIDI and all that kind of stuff. But then, you know, seeing that kind of thing there, that's like, oh, that's quite interesting. Because it's also, Shaka was doing the same thing at the same time. Because when I had my first album out with Shaka, he was working in a studio in Brixton, a studio called Barrington Road Studio. And in the studio, I had a small room with like seven Yamaha DX7s linked up to a little Roland MC500, a couple of small mixers going to that. And he had this keyboard player that was a wicked keyboard player, a guy he named as Andy Mozart. And as you know, everything was coming out of these seven keyboards, and it was sounding, yeah, that's wicked for such a small and really, you know, one man kind of production. You know, I was like, yeah, that kind of suited me because it was, you know, me and my brother doing our thing at home. So it's like, yeah, we can't have a band, but we can make things sound better by maybe going into this MIDI route of things, you know. So, you know, straight away, it's like, I remember going back home and just like, instead of programming a drum machine to sound like a drummer, it was like, make it sound like a machine. Mm-hmm. So partly through the likes of Dread and Fred and Shaka, it was just like that was it, you know. But obviously we all have our own different influences and style of how we do things. So, you know, how I wasn't trying to emulate Dread and Fred or Shaka. It was just trying to make it have this certain vibe. Yeah. I think that's what kind of happened. That's then when our scene started to have its own kind of sound and structure. But, you know, you could look at someone like Alpha and Omega, and Alpha Omega wasn't trying to do that at all. Alpha and Omega had their own sound, you know.
But they loved Blue Peril.
they love Lee Perry. You can hear that, obviously. You know,
I mean, that would be another question. Is it like when you started, you thought, like, I want to be like scientist, I want to be like
Terminator,
I want to use elements like whatever.
Yeah, I mean, for mixing, I always love scientists. You know, King Tubby's is the master. Mm. But, you know, when I was getting into reggae, it was really a scientist was the man that was coming through. So I particularly love scientists. Mm. But musically, it was like people like Freedom Sounds. Yabby, you, Pablo in particular, you know, I mean, them three there. And I loved Shaka music at that time, you know what I mean? So that kind of influence all sort of intermingled was what was like, you know, sort of gelling me to make music.
Would you say that then a certain scene started to come together?
Yes.
In the early 90s? Labels with you starting making records, Ja Warrior, I think starting similar.
Ja Warrior, slightly late, yeah.
Alpha and Omega releasing their albums. Was it then like, our scene?
Yeah, it did become like that, you know. But still, nothing planned. It just, you know, we was just all doing a thing, you know. But it was getting sort of quite a high profile. Like I say, through Manasseh, you know, they was quite high profile in all of it. But then we was also getting an outside interest from other kinds of music, from house and techno and stuff. And so that interests the media then.
Don't forget the clubs.
And the club, yeah. Well, there was lots of different things. But the media, you know, we was getting lots of interviews, and then there's, you know, you start getting labels that come along wanting tracks for compilations and stuff. It's slightly later, but, you know, it did all become this kind of more overground. When it was, you know, when we first went into it, it was very deeply underground. Mm. You know, it really kind of started to come overground and stuff and get a lot of notice taken of it. Although still not really dealt with properly. You know, it was still, if you was making a dub, but then, you know, sort of making it with breakbeats, you'd probably get more kudos for that, you know what I mean? Because I always see reggae, you know, outside of reggae, they always see it as though, oh, it's just all reggae, you know. But we kind of know our strength is that it is what it is. It is reggae, you know what I mean? Not to change it, you know?
Your personal situation in that time was like, I mean, it's kind of not that easy decision for like a young man at that age to say, okay, I do music for Shaka dances or I have a proper job. I was working at the time.
Yeah. I was working in a psychiatric hospital, in the stores department and stuff. Not a great job, but it was an easy job, you know? And making the music was, to me, just a hobby. It was literally that. I liked to go into the sessions, and if Shaka would be playing my dubs, then that was great, you know what I mean? It's like, yeah, you know. But at the same time, you know, as years kind of go on, because it was over a five-year period that I was making tunes for Shaka, strictly. And, you know, it's like all the time there was, you know, it's like, yeah, you know, there's other people coming up and in the scene and stuff like that. So you want to kind of move forward and stuff. You know, and I felt like Shaka really is on no better level than me or you as a record label. It's not like he's a big record label or a big rich man that does his thing. He's just a guy that's doing his thing, you know. And I always felt like I was putting pressure on him to, you know, what's going to happen next, well, the next release and this and that, you know. And I knew he had his own things that he was dealing with and other people's projects and stuff like that. So it came to a point where it's like I kind of knew that, yeah, I have to take myself seriously. Now, you know, it's no longer going to be a hobby. It's going to be, you know, my life. So then you kind of have to look into releasing your own tunes.
Starting the label
and all that, you know. And I had no real idea. It's like I wasn't, you know, it's not like I was big chummy mates with Shaka to sit down. Yeah, Shaka, how do we do this? How do we do that? You know what I mean? It was, so you just have to find out yourself, you know. So you find out how much it costs to manufacture a tune. Okay, that's, you know, it's like, for 500, 12 inches, £600. It's like, well, I can afford that. Beforehand, you might be thinking, you know, it's like it's going to be grands and stuff, but no, £600, it's no problem. So you go into that, and then you think, you know, once you've gone into the cutting house and cut your tune, then you start to think, how do I sell it now? You know, so it's like the record shops, a distributor, and blah, blah, blah. Didn't know none of that. I had a friend that used to help Blacker Dread with his label and stuff. And he took me to a couple of distributors at the time. Fat Shadow was one. Fat Shadow took some stock, but they were exports. So it was still kind of small amount. Did most of the running around to the record shops, and there was, you know, you had record shops in them days. So you did all that, 10 copies here, a box there and stuff. Took me to another distributor called SRD, which was, you know, not a reggae distributor, just more of a kind of dance music distributor. And they had things like Shaka's catalogue and I think Mad Professor and maybe Twinkle Brothers, but wasn't really doing too much with that. Took one copy of my 12-inch and, you know, didn't know about us and didn't think no more about it. But I just carried on, you know, and I sold 1,000 copies of my first 12-inch Pran and Lion within a few months. Went and started to do my next 12-inch, didn't manufacture that. And my friend, you know, said, how did you do with the first one? I said, yeah, done 1,000 copies. So he took me back up to SRD and we saw the guy and, you know, he told the guy there. It's like, well, you know, you see the man who's done 1,000 copies just going on foot around some record shops in London. So they took the next tune. You know, I took a few hundred copies of it and took some couple of hundred copies of the previous one and stuff. And you know, they started selling. Things was just flying out, you know. And we had a good period at that time, you know, that sort of from 93 to 95 was a very good period for us. And Germany in particular was a big market. Half of our stock at least must have come to Germany. But it was a new market, you know. It's like the crowd in Germany didn't really know anything beforehand. I think probably a lot of them come from more the kind of techno and house side, but could hear, you know, heard something in a lot of our things that they liked and stuff. And it was all great, you know. We started coming over and doing shows and tours and worked with a few people and stuff.
Was that the time when the DJing or the record playing came in for you?
No, we started because I started the sound system in 91.
Okay, the sound system 91.
Yeah.
Okay.
We was asked to DJ by Joey J. Joey J was also on Kiss FM. You know, I'd become quite a popular DJ on the roots scene, and he was running a club in Dingwalls in Camden Town. And my brother had done a magazine. He had started a magazine, I think, in 88, a Boom Shakalaka, a little fanzine. And Joey J had seen this, and, you know, through that, it was like, invite us up to do a guest spot playing some tune at this club. So we did that, you know, and I run a couple of, you know, my brother was playing mostly Revive and stuff, and I run a couple of new productions, a couple with Sister Rashida. And, you know, they went down nice. Then Joey started up another club in Southall. And, you know, we was playing on his sound system, and there was an Asian sound system called Eastern Shear. So, you know, it was a night of us three playing on this, and it was boom, you know, it was like 500 people there and everybody going mad and loving it and stuff like that. And it kind of gave me the bug for it, you know. But the thing with playing on someone else's sound sometimes is like, you know, it's like you can't go to the levels that you need to do, you need to go to, because, you know, reggae sound system is a thing where it's like, you know, you really are playing the sound system. It's not just put a tune on and you know. Yeah, you really are playing the thing hard. And, you know, I was always getting tapped on the shoulder by Joey. It's like, hold down the bass for us, hold down the bass. It's like, yeah, but it's the vibes, what the people want, you know. So, okay, I kind of figured, right, I'll look into getting my own sound system, you know. So I looked into my finances and things like that. And, you know, I got the money together to build my own sound. So, like, by the following year, I had my own sound then. And, you know, we was already kind of established. We had our name through the music through being played through Shaka. So straight away we had crowd, you know. In the early 90s as well, there was Culture Promotions, who was Shaka's promoter, started up a dub club at the Dome in Tufnell Park. So we were playing there quite regular, and enough other sounds and DJs was playing up there. So the scene was very positive at that time, you know, enough things were going off. And you had, you know, Abashanti come out in the early 90s, and Iration Steppers come down from Leeds. So it was like, you know, these things are going off. Shows, you know, loads of shows in London. There were shows in Southend, you know, outside of London and stuff, which seemed a popular area for all that kind of things. Up in Bradford, we used to play up in Bradford, you know, sort of up in Yorkshire with Iration and with Roots Man. You know, it was quite a positive
thing.
Quite
vital.
Yeah. You know, but a lot of work running around with your sound system and stuff.
Was the whole, I call it the Shaka phenomenon, from the garage deck to the boxes to the tunes to the top 100 dog plate killers and the whole kind of legacy, I would call.
Yeah.
Was that a must-have, like, at that time?
Not really. I mean, there was a way that you went with a sound system, you know what I mean? But myself, it was like I never felt the need to, that I needed a Garrard deck, or I needed, you know, the H&H tape echo. I've got those things now.
Okay, that was not the thing.
But they wasn't, to me, they wasn't the necessary elements. That was Shaka.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, I don't want to be a carbon copy of Shaka. Mm-hmm. I can't be. I'm a white guy for a start. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I haven't got that history to be that. You know, so it's like I use my old JVC turntable. It was quite fine enough for me. But single turntable, we didn't need no double decks or nothing, you know. Amps I got, there was transistor amps from Jar Tubbies, you know, scoop bins and whatever, you know. But it was like, you know, the whole thing was the music. It was about the music and how you portray that and how you operate that to people. That's the legacy of Shaka.
Mm-hmm. Because I find it quite interesting how many people nowadays actually feel like this is really the thing, like even having the dub cuts for certain tunes, Wailing Souls, whatever, only Shaka had, where certain people say, I have it from that time, he gave it to me on that, or whatever. Wasn't at that time the same thing that he gave you something in return?
No, Shaka don't give you no music. No. I mean, Shaka, the story was always around, even from them times, was like, you know, if you ask Shaka for a dub, it would be like me giving leaves out of my Bible, you know what I mean? So it's like, no, you didn't get tuned from Shaka. But I never felt to ask. I felt that was his thing, you know. You don't go ask another sound man for his tunes. You go to the labels and the producers and the artists to see about them kind of things. You know, that's what Shaka was still doing. Shaka at that time was still going to Jamaica, going down to King Tubby's and Jammies and whoever, Lego Sounds and whatever. I was going to New York to see some of the studios there and get bits and pieces.
So Shaka was quite aware that he was the one everyone was looking at.
I would have thought he would be aware. Yeah, for sure. Because, you know, although there were some other sounds, you know, like Jar Observer wasn't really, as far as I could see, they wasn't really playing out anything regular at that time. Channel 1 might have been, but Channel 1 slightly had a different... they were playing the universities. They had a different arena that they would play in. They got into this university circuit. Very good for them because it pays quite good money, you know. But it wasn't so much in amongst their scene. I saw Shaka play with Channel 1.
Mm-hmm.
So you knew that they was about and stuff, but you know I didn't really. I followed Shaka. I didn't follow no other sounds, you know. So I didn't really kind of have an interest in what else might have been going around. Shaka to me was the focus, and I think probably for a lot of people was the same, you know. So because he had the bigger history, you know, no matter how much you know popularity some other sounds might have now, you know, amongst people you see on some of the forums, I love this sound or I love that sound. It's like they ain't got 40 years of history like Shaka to that same level. So, you know, that's not a disrespect. That's just how it is.
It is.
How
did you deal personally with the Rastafari thing coming from the music, from the whole scene, from even the people in the audience standing somehow around you?
I always kind of, you know, my personal feeling for Rastafari is like it's a personal religion anyway. You know, it's not really, there might be a set of rules and precepts to it, but, you know, a lot of time it's like they're your own set of rules and precepts. I'm not a Rasta. I've never, you know, I don't dreadlocks up. I don't, you know, I don't need repatriation to Africa or none of that. That's not for me because I'm a white guy from the suburbs. I can't make no difference about my history there. But it's to have respect for them things still. And it's like, you know, a tune that's talking about them kind of things. It's not just talking about them things, you know, because the guys that are singing about them things didn't, you know, they didn't go through slavery themselves. But it's their history. And you know, if it's their history, it's like it's the world's history as well. So you have respect and understanding for them type of things there. So I've got no problem with that. And, you know, Jar and all them kind of things. Well, Jar is a word. It's a meaning for God. It's like you can have your own interpretation of what God is to you, you know, because every religion has that, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it's not for me to war with another guy about what he thinks
So you never felt alienated?
No. But then, I wasn't going down to Shaka and shouting out Jar in the dance and stuff because I knew that wasn't me, you know what I mean? But at the same time, you know, if you was in them dances that time then, and Shaka would say Jar and a mic and the whole crowd would go, Rastafari, you'd feel something from that. You know,
strong
impact. I'd get goosebumps on my arms the same way, you know what I mean? It's like, yeah, because that's a people thing, you know. All these things, churches and, you know, Ground Nation in Jamaica and stuff, it's a gathering of people. And you know, all since time, the gathering of people has been a thing. It's about people getting together and joining in some kind of unity. That is a thing. Whether you want to put that down to a religion, a god, your vision of that, or whatever, it's still the gathering of people. And the spirit that goes around through that.
So the next step was then producing other artists, as far as I would say. Sister Rashida,
yeah,
for example.
Well, you know, because because we come from a reggae background, yeah. You know, it's like, you know, people want to define now this difference between reggae and dub in particular. But me, it's like, I don't see that at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, dub comes from reggae music. And although we had to do dub, just through the circumstances, because we didn't know singers or we didn't have the facilities for voicing and all that kind of stuff. You know, even when we're building our dub tunes from the early times and that, in our heads, in our vision, it was just like, oh, it'd be great if we had singers on this and stuff. So that was the next progression when we could start doing that, when we started finding artists and had the facilities to do them things. You know, it was, the first person that I was to link up with to do any voicing was Jonah Dan. You know, we kind of linked through a guy that worked in a record shop. And so he come down and he brought down Sister Rashida. Mm-hmm. I think, as I remember, to try and either to help you with harmonies or to guide you with some vocal technique or something, you know what I mean? But she liked some of the tunes that we were playing and started voicing on them things, you know. But she later linked up with a record label called Roots Records and they kind of took control of her project. But all the music was, you know, produced by myself and, you know, engineered, mixed by me, blah, blah, blah. But it was interesting for that. And it was starting to move itself away from this kind of stricter dub thing into making roots reggae. And I always loved contemporary reggae anyway. You know, even, you know, I wasn't a big fan of Sling Teng, but tempo was a great rhythm, you know. It had that heaviness and weight and stuff. So any rhythm that had that sort of heaviness and weight for me in reggae from Jamaica, it was like, yeah, I loved all that stuff. So, you know, all through the 90s, you know, it was things like Exterminator Label and Penthouse and Digital B, African Star and all these Jamaican. I loved that. Mm. You know what I mean? I was like, I would rather hear a song than just hear a raw dub.
Mm.
If you hear a raw dub, but you know that dub is of a song, then, you know, you put the two and two together. You know, that's the kind of naturalness of dub music.
And was it like, I want to work with Johnny Clark, I want to work with who else?
No, we never, we could never think of that, you know.
But it was not like that kind of fulfilling your own likes for the music in the first place?
Not really, no. No, it wouldn't have mattered who we had been working with, really. You know, all them things would be nice and stuff. But it's all... You know, I never really kind of felt myself maybe even worthy of working with some people like that. You know?
Well, those days, you were just happy to get a vocalist.
Right? Yeah, you was, and partly because as well, you're trying to learn your trade at recording all that. It's so easy for people now. You know, you have a computer and you know you build tunes and you know you can get cheap bits of gear. You couldn't do all that so easy back in them times. So, you know, learning how to record vocals, you know, how it kind of, you know, the quality of your microphone and all that kind of stuff. It takes time to do them things. We never had nobody. I never had nobody show me nothing.
Coaching you.
No. So, you know, it's like, okay, you know, if I had got Johnny Clark on my first tunes, it would be a totally embarrassing embarrassment right now, you know what I mean? So I'm kind of glad that things just kind of took their evolutionary course as they did.
Was something like doing a Rashida album the first thing where you realized, okay, I can make a living from that? Getting into the producer's chair somehow?
You know, again, it all come by circumstance. You know, up until 93, I was working, you know, my job. But I was made redundant in 93, but 93 was like, I was made redundant just about 2 months after I put my first own record out. So when I was made redundant, it was just like, okay, there ain't no other job for me. You know, I'm not I didn't go to I left school at 15, you know, I mean, I've got no skills in anything else. Let me see how this thing goes with the music. But at the same time, you know, I sold 1,000 copies of that tune, and the next one was, you know, sort of being lined up and stuff. And I just thought, let me try this out and see how it goes. And it was just, it kind of was at the right time. And because, you know, when you, with the, when them tunes, it's like, it's me alone, it's one person. So if I sell 1,000 records at £2 each, I'm making money on that. And I started making some relatively okay, better money than I was making working in the psychiatric hospital. You know, and it just kind of carried on from there. And I think I've always been a bit wise in how I do things, you know. So, you know, it's like you've got to keep busy in this scene. It's like, you know, you can't sort of outprice yourself and them kind of things. So I just kind of kept on working. And it's just been that way ever since. I make a living. I wouldn't say, you know, I make a rich living. I certainly don't, you know. But it keeps me going. I'd rather be happy doing that than, you know, miserable working in a job that I didn't like or, you know, some other thing.
Mm-hmm. I think from my point of view, in the second half of the 90s, somehow the electronic and techno element became a bit more bigger than the reggae element.
Yes.
The whole thing.
Yeah.
Which from my point of view, as just as a listener, brought the whole thing down a bit.
Yeah. I mean, I would kind of agree with that. You know, it's like I said, when we first started, the whole influence was reggae. My first set of tunes was really more reggae-fied than anything else. But, you know, it kind of went into this thing where it started taking on these kind of, you know, because we was using computers and MIDI and all that sort of stuff, it became more kind of industrialized like that. But at the same time, it was very fresh for the scene, you know. And I kind of, I hoped that I kind of, myself, was trying to keep on the right side of it so it had enough that kept it playable. You know, the thing was, the defining thing for me is like, can Shaka play it? If Shaka can play it, then it's okay. And I knew certain styles that he couldn't play. You know, you wouldn't go to Shaka and you wouldn't start hearing, say, too much Adrian Sherwood stuff.
Yeah, that's right.
Or Dreadzone or The Orb or something like that. You know, it was just too left field.
Mm.
So I was trying to keep it into the right field that would fit for Shaka. I've done some stuff that was kind of more left field for a couple of other labels and stuff, but mostly my concentration was to make tunes that fitted in with our scene, because I was running sound at that time, so I also needed to play the tunes myself. So hopefully we kind of kept it in the way. But it was being pushed into a certain arena by the forces outside of us.
Mm-hmm.
And for myself, that's when I really kind of rebelled by 95, 96. You know, I had some record companies that was coming to me asking me for tunes for their compilations.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd show them, you know, I'd send a tune to them and they say, oh, can you put house hi-hat? Can you put a breakbeat in it? Can you do this? Can you do that?
Or to the floor.
Yeah. You know what I mean? And it's just like, that ain't what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I ain't that. I ain't a techno bot. I come from reggae. Reggae's my background. And so it's like, you know, I got sick and tired of being told how I should build my music. You know, if you're coming to me, you accept what I give you. If you don't like it, you don't like it. It's no loss to me, you know. So I rebelled, and that's when I really kind of wanted to concentrate more back on the roots thing, start working with singers and just make reggae as far as I could make it, as it should be, instead of some left-field weirdness. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with left-field weirdness. It's okay, but it's for other people. It's not for me. So... yeah, it was a thing to kind of be a bit more strict and show people it's like, this is more the direction than making it too kind of weird and techno-y.
Was that maybe a reason why I didn't continue Boom Shakalaka label and said, okay, yes, you lay that aside and leave that?
Yeah. I mean, and as well, you know, I felt that even with that style that we was doing for the Boom Shakalaka label, it was, I felt, you know, I kind of progressed as far as I could with it.
Mm.
You know, where did I go with it from there? You know, it's like I've done all my fluty melodies, I've done all my string melodies and stuff like that, you know. The only way you could take it any further was by getting it more techno-y and weirder. Mm. And I didn't want to go that direction.
Mm. Okay.
That was for your Dreadzones and Orbs or whoever, you know. All I can do is, you know, reggae, when it comes down, reggae is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
You start making it anything else and it's not reggae no more, you know.
The original thing is gone.
Yeah. And I wasn't, you know, I wasn't big into dancehall, so I wasn't going to start making too much kind of bashment-y type of things and stuff like that. That wasn't for myself either. Yeah, I did try, you know, experiment. If you have a studio, you experiment with anything, you know, because you've got time to do them kind of things. I did one or two things, and a couple come out on some different, you know, one come out with the Serious Dropout People and stuff, some remix that I did, you know, add a kind of bashy flavour to that stuff. It's interesting to do them things, but that's not my vision of what I want to do. You know, if someone comes along and asks you to do something particularly for their project, then, you know, you can say, yeah, I can do that, you know. Or you can say, no, it's not for me right now. Well, no, there's, you know, I've not got no strict rule about nothing. But in my heart, what I want to do is reggae music. And if you're making reggae music for singers, you've got to make something that works for them the same way. You know, I remember when we had Prince Allah down, and someone had given me a couple of rhythms for him to voice specials on while he was down in the studio and stuff. And one of them was just, you know, Prince Allah heard it and stuff and was just like, it didn't make sense to him at all. Just like, he's looking at it sort of, what is it? You know what I mean? Because it just, it didn't have the right flavour to suit him. Okay, he's an older school guy, so he's, maybe, you know.
There was no relationship. There's no relationship. Music and him,
yeah. But the things that we was giving him to voice, yeah, he had no problem with them things. He wasn't sitting there thinking there was anything different than what he had been voicing in recent times and stuff, you know. So you have to kind of make that distinction about, you know, what you want to do and you know, what suits this music. Yeah. So
and at the same time, like, when you experienced that thing, Blood and Fire and Pressure Sounds dropped there, stuff which a huge media impact from my point of view. All of a sudden, those two labels have been digging out the stuff that have been yours.
Our influence.
Your secret. I've never been with Freedom Songs.
But I've never been one that's kind of been secret about it. You know, my brother did the magazine and he was talking about the music from them times. We wanted people to learn about and understand this music, but understand it properly, you know, because a lot of the music press before that, too many myths about reggae music, you know. It's like, there's nothing mythical about it. You know, it might seem magical to you that Lee Perry has got this sound, or King Tubby did this thing, the EQ, but it is only an EQ. It is only a phaser that Lee Perry is using. Yeah, he's put it to an imagination, but it's not mystical, you know. It's just technique.
If you would have another phaser at the same time in the studio, it would sound completely different.
Yeah, of course it would do, you know. Because the man's imagination. But the thing was not to keep, you know, to lay the music in front of people as it should be. We're not going to say, this mystical tune, this and that, and blah, blah, blah. It's like, you know, to make it even more mystical, put different names to things to confuse people and stuff. No, we tell it as it is. So we never, you know, my brother never hid it from people in that times there. Anybody now, you know, can come up and ask me about tunes if I know about them. I'm going to tell them about them. I'm not going to give people music. I don't do that. You know, like, everybody wants to file share music and stuff these days. It's like, no, that ain't good for the music. You know what I mean? That ain't actually be. I had to go out hunting the music. I might have had it in a time when it was kind of nice and easy and cheap to come by, going to the record and tape shops and stuff. But that's my circumstance. If your circumstance is different now, if you can't afford to pay £80 for a rare record on eBay or something, well, don't pay £80 for it. Go to the record shop and buy the latest Blood and Fire album and support that instead. There's enough music you can get out there before you need to get into the deep stuff. You know, just be patient with it. These days, everybody wants everything now. You know, this whole computer generation. Download
the Greensleeves 12-inch catalogue.
That's it. It's madness. For us, it was like trying to find them tunes over, you know, a decade of years, you know what I mean? It's just like, nah. But I was kind of happy just, you know, if we picked up one here and one there, that was it. We sat there and we was happy with what we had. We didn't need to listen to a million tunes that meant nothing to us. We went out and bought the tunes that meant something to us, you know? So, I kind of think, in a way, it's just like, you know, some of that needs to come back right now for people to really, you know, get a love for the music. I don't really think a lot of people love the music, you know. And it's, in some respect, even the thing, you know, with our this kind of UK dub scene and stuff, you know, that a lot of people that have got into that don't really know a lot about reggae music, don't search the history of it and stuff, you know what I mean? all they really want is boof, 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 boof in their head for a few hours on a night and done. And it's just like, well, no, it should mean a little bit more than that, really. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't have to, but, you know.
Whoever has a certain approach, yeah, has it, yeah, like, whatever.
That's right, you know.
And when did the backyard movement thing...
Well, that backyard movement, yeah, that was in 1996.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I linked up with an artist called High Priest. Mm-hmm. High Priest was formerly a DJ named DJ Pebbles, who had worked with Coxon, mm-hmm, Lloydy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was one of Coxon's mic men from a long time ago. But he'd started, he moved from DJing into singing.
Well, he originally came from Sopra Sound.
Yeah. But he was one of Coxon's mic men. Mm-hmm. But I did a tune with him, and it was just like part of my thinking at the time. You know, we used to in Echoes magazine, Black Echoes magazine. You know, if they reviewed our dub tunes, it's like not just mine, but anybody on the dub scene, it would usually get a very bad review because they wouldn't see it as legitimate. You know, it's like it's white UK dub stuff. You know what I mean? The real stuff is what comes from Jamaica. So we always got slated in there.
Okay.
But my thinking was, well, you know. Partly my thinking was like, okay, you have one page of reviews. Why review stuff if you don't like it? You know what I mean? It's like, put a review of something in there you do like. You know, show people tunes that they want to go out and buy. Don't take it as a place to slag people off. But the other thing was like, for me personally, it was like, okay, you're slagging that stuff off, but you don't really understand it. You know, the guy that did the review was like, he ain't been to Shaka for 15 years. He doesn't know what's going on down in that scene. Thinks it's just a bunch of white, spliffed out people, you know what I mean? No, but you go to Shaka and there's 1,000 people in this dance enjoying it, you know what I mean? Having a good time and stuff. And it's not all white people, you know? And my thing with the Backyard Movements when I did this first tune was to send them a white label copy of the test press, mm-hmm, just with the artist name and the title. And see what they would make of that.
Mm-hmm.
And it got a good review. Mm-hmm. So to me, it was like, okay, you're dissing us on one form of the music, but we're quite capable of making something you can like. So why are you differentiating? You know what I mean? So like, even just to myself, I kind of proved the point.
Yeah. Which is important.
Yeah. And it was just like, you know, you just carry on from there. And I liked working with singers and stuff like that. You know, it's like I don't have to, if I'm building a tune then, it's like I don't have to sit there thinking of, you know, cheesy flute melodies and strings and all that to put on top to fit it out. It's like the singer will fit it out, you know. So I can just concentrate on the drum and bass and the mix and stuff like that. And that was it for me, you know. Just like, yeah, just kind of carry on this thing. But at the same time, you know, I still was within a scene, you know, that liked dub and stuff. So we're still doing some of that. And I did revitalise the Boom Shaka Laka label for a few releases, you know, after a certain number of years. And they sold all right, you know, it kind of went all right. But it's still, my focus is not on that.
Mm.
You know,
that yesterday, you are not looking too much at the past.
Yeah.
That's not
your vision. You know, part of business tells it. It's like, yeah, re-release these things or do some reissue or something, you know what I mean? Because there's new people now that didn't get them things from 10, 15 years ago or whatever. So, you know, yeah, put it out and make something of that. Part of me, when doing them kind of things, it's like, you know, it's almost like this, you know, you've got to a point where you're putting out a best of, and when you see that point, surely you're done now, you know what I mean? It's like, that's your death knell. So part of me don't really want to do that, you know? But at the same time, okay, it's business and things change, so you just do that. I know I'm still producing stuff, new stuff, and, you know, I've got plans and ideas of what I want to do for the future, and that's really my kind of more my concentration is just, you know.
Okay, so nowadays,
mm-hmm,
the thing between Jamaica and what you do and mm-hmm what others do and the development actually in the Jamaican stuff, reggae-wise.
Yeah.
I know the same thing. I know quite a lot of people my age, like 40, being 15 years in the reggae business, who are... claim that what you do nowadays is a better reggae than what the Busy Signals, the Mavados, right, and the Jamaican dancehall producers, mm-hmm, maybe even the Jamaican roots producers like Fatista,
right,
what they do, that they can't, that it has not the quality, and it is not the, what do you call it, yeah, quality, I think it's the right word, yeah. Production-wise, I mean, musically, than what you provide.
Yeah.
Or other people in England provide.
Yeah, well, you know, that's different people's points of view, yeah, and taste, obviously. You know, things like Busy Signal and you know, that whole kind of dancehall and bashy kind of stuff. Mm. You know, that's a different world as far as I'm concerned. I've listened to some of that, you know, when it was kind of coming through, when Beanie Man did Who Am I, you know, I loved that rhythm. I thought that rhythm was wicked. And then all them things that was done by Scared M Crew and Mo Wax and, you know, a lot of the Jazzwad and whoever. Some wicked rhythms. I wasn't really concerned about most of the vocals on them because it's mostly just Soundboy chat or Gal chat or mm-hmm. some other nonsense, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But it was very interesting rhythms. But then it sort of, for me personally, it kind of, one of the kind of tunes that come along, which I actually liked, Bookshelf, mm-hmm. rhythm on that was fantastic, and you know, the tune itself was a fantastic tune. But then, you know, every dancehall producer wanted to produce another Bookshelf, so everything mm-hmm. started to sound the same. And then it sort of got really minimalist, just got down to a beat, you know, mm-hmm. no melodies, no ethereal themes and all that, which was interesting on a lot of them kind of mm-hmm. stuff previously. Just boom, boom, and a guy mm-hmm. ranting his head off on top of it, and that mm-hmm. didn't really interest me, you know what I mean? And so I kind of lost my interest in that kind of stuff and never really kind of got back into it. But it's as legitimate as anything else. But at the same time, it's not speaking to everybody. Lyrically, it's not speaking to everybody. Maybe style-wise, it's not speaking to everybody. For me, I loved all the stuff from Exterminator and Penthouse and Digital B and all them kind of labels that was coming through in the 90s and stuff. And to me, that was like, that was the bigger influence than anything else.
Mm.
Love the sound, love the production, love the style, lyrical content and all them kind of things there. And it's like, if anything, you know, a lot of the dub producers could be taking more of a lesson from that than anything else. You know, even some of the mixing that started to come on things later, Stephen Stanley is like one of the best engineers in Jamaica. What he does on a digital rhythm when he really gets into a mixing mode, it's just like, boy, ain't nobody matching that. You know,
he's quite good.
It's very good. In Bowlby, mm-hmm. Solji, them three engineers there are just, yeah, top guys. But dub means nothing in Jamaica.
Yeah.
Hasn't done from the early 80s. Yeah. So they was making it, you know, even a lot of the Exterminator stuff. You know, I remember in the early 90s, I think it was, hearing the Fattest had come over to London and had actually checked Shaka playing at the Rocket and could see, you know, suddenly looking around and seeing, you know, the Rocket's 1,500, 2,000 people going mad to these heavy steppers rhythms and stuff like that. And that set a little thing in his head. And you know, even a tune like Praise Ye Jah, it's like, you can't really imagine that being made for Jamaica. Right, just the rhythm alone, it's like, that ain't made for Jamaica. Yeah. That's made for us London Shakarites.
Yeah.
You know?
That's right. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So that was, you know, obviously we had an influence on him to make tunes, because if he's seeing 2,000 people at dance, it's like, oh, that's setting dollar bills up in his mind, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the labels were doing things like that. So there was a lot of great music. And you know, myself, you know, I listen to Studio One. So if I listen to Studio One, I don't always need a big, heavy rhythm, you know, because barely any Studio One is big, heavy rhythms. Most of it's kind of more rubber-dub and dancehall of its day, you know. So I've got no problem with listening to an Exterminator on another lick of Real Rock or something. You know what I mean? Might not be for the Shaka crowd, but it's like, it's all right by me. It's fine by me, you know. Digital B licking over some Treasure Isle track or whatever. It's great. Yeah.
Okay.
So I got no problem with that. But some people want it to be very specific. They want this heaviness and this dreadness, and it's like, it's all got to be banging. And
like the other ones wanted the bling bling and the
Movados. Yeah.
It's the same thing.
But you know, the same thing, you know, it's like, okay, you know, you have an area of people within the UK dub kind of thing there saying, it's like all that stuff, you know, the Busy Signal, all that dancehall stuff's rubbish and this and that, blah, blah, blah. But at the same time, you don't get none of the dancehall crowd really checking the UK dub thing. They're as biased against our thing as maybe our people are against that. So, you know, it's all six of one and half a dozen of another, you know what I mean? We should have our opinion as well. It doesn't mean it's any less legitimate. Yeah.
And when you have even the Lovers thing in between, and people like Lloydie Brown or
Peter Gale,
Mafia and Fluxy, what they do,
That's right.
So that's like another thing.
That's another thing, yeah.
With another... Yeah. Yeah.
And then you have your street revivalist that only listen to revival,
you
know.
So. Yeah, and you have Pete McLean, what Chris did with him.
And yeah, that kind of thing. Yeah. So, you know, there's all these little segments, and none is really any better than the other. We're just doing our thing for our audience. We have an audience for our UK dub thing.
Mm.
You know, we're quite... I'm quite happy with that. I've got no problem with that. You know, do you think your dance hall audience is better than ours?
It's
not. They're the same type of people.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, you know. But I think sometimes it's a bit stupid. I know, I think in the kind of late 80s, early 80s, a certain few people within our scene was like slagging off what Jamaica was doing at that time there. And obviously the kind of reggae crowd didn't like that.
Mm.
So it was like, you know, but the reggae crowd had the more kind of upfront media attention. Mm. So it's like they could easily slag us off, you know, where it was like harder for us to get publicly seen as slagging off them. You know. So we could never make any way. So our thing did kind of, it was always kept down in its own little groove.
Okay, so two more things. The one thing is the internet thing. How do you see that? I mean, especially your personal situation, when I look at the Blood and Fire board, every third thread has the sentence, about ask Rusty about it. He might know.
Well, the Blood and Fire forum in particular has kind of, you know, got a bit of a Shaka takeover, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it never used to be that. I was on Blood and Fire from, I think, about 96, 97, something like that. Mm. I started to get on the internet and see these forums. I think I was on... the reggae music, I can't remember what they call it now. There was these just internet forums, you know what I mean? Record, reggae, something or other.
Yeah,
I was on that before.
Yeah,
like,
news groups.
The news group. And that was quite popular. Most of the people that went later on to Blood and Fire was all on that news group until they changed the format of the news groups and how you posted and all that sort of stuff. So then, it all went into Blood and Fire. But then, you know, Blood and Fire was literally just the same as what the news group was, up until more recent years, where it seems to have got this this takeover by a lot of the younger Shakaites, which has maybe not gone down so well with some of the older roots heads.
Mm.
But you know.
I find it phenomenal. It's a phenomenon to me because there are so many people asking about, like, is there a third dub to Johnny Clark, Poor Marcus, and then
there's a lot of obsessive people, you know. I mean,
hardcore. It's the thing that when I said about the Garage Decks and the Beatles and how it's supposed to be.
Oh well, I've like the thing like the sirens and stuff. I get a little bit irate about that. Nothing too much, but you know, someone saying they've got to have the NJD. It's only the NJD siren that sounds like this thing, and it's like, well, I've had an NJD. When I used to build the things in the early 90s. I built 100 of the things, and my home built one never sounded any different from the NJD. It was exactly the same. Then I started dealing with Jartubby's ones, and Jartubby's ones just sound like my ones. The only difference is, and even if you had 10 of the original NJD in a row, they would all sound subtly different. But all that subtlety would be was like in slight pitch differences because of the tolerances of components.
Mm-hmm.
And so the tolerances of components in Tubbies is using new components as opposed to them older ones, is that sometimes the pitches can be slightly higher. But it's the same cycle of pitches.
Okay.
They're all doing, you know what I mean? There's no difference in that at all. And yet people are insisting to me that it's different. And it's like, I've opened up the things, I see what the transistors and the resistors and the diodes are in there, they're all the same way. You know what I mean? You're only fooling yourself if you think the original NJD is any better than any of these other copies that's out there. But people, you know, part of the thing with that is that people just want this historical part of it. The Garrard deck is a beautiful deck I've got on. You know what I mean? I wouldn't DJ it with a thing, but it's a beautiful looking piece of ancient history. So I bought it on that thing alone. You know, one time when I get my own place and can have a nice music room for my hi-fi and all my records and stuff, I'm going to set that up with a valve amp and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, that's going to be my setup for listening to my old tune and stuff, you know. And I got the H&H much later. I don't really take it out too much because the thing's too big and bulky, you know. So I ain't going to carry it to Germany, you know what I mean? It's like I'd be paying, you know, £100 excess fare or something.
And it might get lost.
It might get lost. The thing doesn't work properly anyway half the time. You always, even when I was going to Shaka, half the time you remember him opening the thing up to kind of move the tape around and get it working again, you know. So, you know, a delay is a delay in the end. It's like, you know, just having these things don't make you Shaka. You know, it's like, be your own thing. Shaka was his thing. You can musically and the way that you push the music to people can be within that field of it, but you know, if you want to be Shaka, then you've got to start going out and make your own double bins and get a big valve bottle amp, and you know, you don't use no speakons or XLRs or nothing. You've got to have bare wires on the back of your thing. You know, it's like, well, you don't need to go to them levels there. You know, that's just, I don't know what that is. You know, that's kind of, that's more fake than anything else. But people have this obsession that having these particular things is going to make what they do better. You know.
So the last thing would be, as I said, I mentioned it yesterday, like 2007, maybe 2008 maybe, is the year where your name has been on most records, or a lot of records.
It's been on a few.
Produced by, mixed by, mastered by, whatever.
Well, you know, the whole mastering thing is a bit funny for me still, you know what I mean? Because I don't consider I'm not a trained mastering engineer, you know. I mean, I just do a thing cheaply for people because I've got the equipment to do it, and people generally that are asking me to do them things don't know how to do them themselves, and to do it, to go and get it properly can be quite expensive. So I just do, and I think, you know, just even have that thing on there that it's like, oh, it's mastered by disciples, gives a bit of kudos to their thing, you know. But I'm just thinking, boy, all I've done is put it through a few processes and, you know, opened up the sound a little bit, you know.
Is it like you ended up in a position like Shaka when, like, you watched him, like, people are now watching you?
I suppose it is, somehow. I mean, it's, you know, I don't think of that, but, I dare say it is, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, but even years back, you know, people used to call me the granddaddy of dub, and it's just like, I'm thinking, boy, you know, I'm not that old.
Just as you said, the UK stamp dub is on it, yeah.
I suppose it is, you know, but I don't know. Myself, I always kind of had my own vision of what I'm doing, so I don't need legitimacy from you know, doing something or the legitimacy of another person to do my thing. You know, I might have needed that when we first started. Well, I don't think I really did. You know, it wasn't, you know, we didn't go to Shaka asking for legitimacy about what we were doing. Just, you know, he's a guy there that's doing his thing. You know what I mean? So, what's your opinion? His opinion was he liked it and played it. Didn't legitify it for me any more than anything else, you know. So I just kind of figure, you know, I don't need to be a carbon copy of anybody. I just go out there and do my thing. And if people like it, they like it. If they don't, you know, okay, there's a next thing that's going to be for them, you know, because that's how it always is.
Mm.
You know, you can't force people to like what you do. Exactly. What to do is, like, try your hardest to do your best and have your own ideas and your own vision of what you're doing, you know. At the moment, you copy him. And, okay, it's fair enough to copy, to learn. But what people are doing when they're doing their copying is just like, you know, straight away they want to release their first tune. And because they realise how easy it is to release their first tune, it's just like, you know, their first tunes are usually pretty junk. There's a, you know, to me, there's a lot of junk music being put out on plastic right now. Maybe if it was 15, 20 years ago, it would have been okay. It was okay for me back then because the scene was really underground, and it wasn't my decision to put out my first records. It was Shaka. These days, you know, it's like, although it's still pretty underground, it's a bit more overground than it is underground. So I think you have to have a bit more care about what you're putting out to the public and stuff, and not just, you know, the care is for yourself. The whole thing with computers and all that these days for making music is it's kind of, it seems as though it's easy, you know. Yeah, it's cheap. Because people can just download a program, they can
do it like that.
Yeah, get a crack copy of Reason and start playing around with it on their, you know, on their home computer and stuff. Build up a little tune that their mates will be impressed with because their mates just wonder how you've done that. Right. And they all start becoming DJs and they're playing it out at their little sessions and stuff, and people are skanking around to it. Well, you could build a tune on a Casio keyboard and people will skank around to it. It doesn't mean it's a good tune, you know. And the thing with a record is it's a finished article.
Mm.
And people are not going to listen to it once. They're not going to listen to it, you know, they're not going to hear it as it is on a sound system with all the embellishment that might give.
Mm.
you know, with mic men and sound effects and the sound thieving away. How does that sound when it's played on your hi-fi? Nine times out of ten, they're sounding pretty shit. Mm. You know, so more care needs to be done of that. And it's you know, people just want to rush things these days. This whole generation of everything's like a clip.
Mm.
This boom, 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 everything's done quick. It's like, well, making music ain't really like that. Mm. Even if you went back to Jamaica, you know, there was all, you know, even amongst people of my generation, you know, music people, when they're talking about, you know, Jamaican productions, you know, whole thing of like, oh, the, you know, Bunny Lee had the revolutionaries in the studio knocking out, you know, 10, 12 rhythms a day and blah, blah, blah. But that's the revolutionaries.
Mm.
That's these musicians that could play.
Mm.
You know what I mean? A whole group of them, yeah. And they might even rehearse. They might know the rhythm beforehand. They might rehearse. The horns man might rehearse the horns thing before they even go in the studio. So when they go in the studio, yeah, they can knock out the 10 rhythms. But even if you check it, half of them Channel 1 rhythms that come out were pretty boring.
Mm.
You know, out of 10, maybe two of them were killer. The rest were just kind of average do-overs. But, you know, average compared to, you know, someone doing something quickly on Reason, it's like, no, it's no comparison. Then things are like 10 times better, you know what I mean? So more care needs to be making when people are making their music on computers and putting it out to the public and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, yeah, everyone starts somewhere. There's nothing wrong with that. But, you know, give yourself some time. Let it develop. Let you develop. Let your skills develop. You know, have an understanding of them things there. You know, so I remember I was talking to a guy a couple of weeks ago, and he was an artist. You know, had gone to art school and stuff. It's like I said to him, yeah, you didn't go into art school, put a canvas up, do a painting, and it's like, expect that painting to go in a gallery. You'd be laughed, you know what I mean? Your tutor would laugh at you. It's like, what are you thinking? You know what I mean? So the same should be with music. You know, you have to learn your art. So it takes time to do them things.
So the final question would be about the artists, the relationship with you as a producer, and them, like, for example, if someone like Michael Rose, whatever, is coming to London, is it like Rusty sitting there saying, "I want Michael Rose to sing on it," or I want to build the rhythm for Michael Rose now?
No, very little. I mean, I think it's got that tradition of reggae that it's just like a lot of things are by opportunity. You know, it's like if I spoke to Michael Rose now, he probably wouldn't remember coming down to my studio. You know, it's like you come down, he gets his fee, does his voice, and then goes off, and that's it. And I'm pretty sure, you know, that's not even far off what he was doing back in the 70s with producers back then, you know. So you don't have a great relationship with people, and it's hard to get to that because we're not big record labels. We can't sort of like say, yeah, Michael Rose, sign this contract and we'll do this for you and that for you. And, you know what I mean? It's like we're one kind of team. You know, we could never get to that kind of level. I can't even do that with local artists and stuff, you know. So, because I know that we couldn't offer them anything more than what we can do. I can only put out a record here and there and stuff. I ain't got the money to kind of back you for doing shows and promotion and what have you.
I mean, but it's not also not the way that you say, I want him. Yeah. He's in London. Or, let's say
I don't hear of these artists being around anyway. You know, you hear about it afterwards.
Yeah.
Oh, so like, Cornel Campbell was in the other week. So like, was he? No one told me. You know what I mean? Some of it's just by opportunity. And because I live outside of London in the suburbs, yeah, there's no kind of like, you know, no movement of that, you know. My linkage with Michael Rose was just through another guy that was running around with Michael Rose and trying to get him as much work as possible. So it was like, do you want to voice Michael Rose? Yeah, that'd be interesting.
Bring him around.
So he brings him down and we do the business and done, you know.
Yeah.
That tends to happen, you know, a few times. You know, there's a couple of tunes that I've got here on 7-inch with an artist called Anthony Q.
Mm-hmm.
He was brought down by another artist, a local artist that I was working with, to help with some harmonies. And, you know, at the same time, once we'd done that, it was just like, yeah, Anthony Q. I didn't really know Anthony Q too well. I had one tune by him, but I couldn't really, you know, it wasn't a big name to me or anything like that at that time. So, yeah, Anthony Q's a good singer, blah, blah, blah. It's like, well, how much are you? He said a price. It's like, okay, let's do a cover tune, you know. He did two tune in 20 minutes.
Mm.
So, you know, paying what we've agreed and done, you know what I mean?
That's it.
So it kind of tends to work out like that. A lot of it's very opportunistic.
But it's not the way that you, with your love for the 70s roots stuff, you say, I want that guy.
No.
And I want this guy.
I mean, you know, you could pull out names everywhere and say, yeah, it'd be great to do. I mean, I love Cornel Campbell from his old times, you know. I mean, it's one of my favourite singers, you know. But I don't know him. I don't know how to link to him. You know, some Swedish guy has released a tune with Willie Williams. I'd love to do a tune with Willie Williams. Who wouldn't, you know? Some guys that are doing some stuff for now in America. It's like, you know, they did a couple of tunes with Judah Eskender Tafara. Great to do a tune with Judah Eskender Tafara, you know what I mean? Some other names that have been mentioned to me, Meditations and so on and so forth. It's like, we'll be wicked, you know what I mean? But you don't always have them connections there to do all
that. It happens
like that. Yeah. And then, you know, it's like, in the end, a lot of it does come down to finances. So, you know, you can't always do the things what you want to do. So a lot of it is opportune. And, you know, there's a few artists that I kind of work with on my local scene. You know, one of my regular kind of artists that I work with is Christine Miller.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she was a harmony singer for another artist that I was doing a lot of work with, Tony Roots. Mm-hmm. And just kind of continue with her. It's on a level that it's, you know, it kind of worked for us. Mm-hmm. So, but that, you know, you get things like that happen over a period of time and stuff. So, you know, you do them kind of things there. But with artists that have a name out there and maybe a history like that, it's very much, yeah, I don't make a decision. It's like, I'm after a particular artist, so I'm going to... that's never happened with me. I know it does happen with some producers.
Mm.
You know, I think Ryan Moore, Twilight Circus, has particularly done that.
Mm.
You know, he had it in mind that he wanted to work with such and such an artist and went out and found the artist and did that works.
It's like fulfilling dreams.
But it's never been the thing that's been within me to do, you know.
Okay.
Mm.
Thank you very much.
Hey, yes. Respects.